Hi, my name is Diane Fright. I guess we get the last word of the last word of the last session. Thank you all for staying and for the opportunity to be here. Thank you. I'm here with my co-author, Jillian McNaughton of Oxford University and now of Northeastern University. Our goal, our hope, is that we explore and begin to explain a different framework for how to ground regulation in a kind of a coherent international normative framework, to go back to ideas from international human rights and to explore that with regard to decent work. Apologies for not sending the paper out. It's going to be published, and so they asked us to stop doing that. It is on SSRN because we had put it there before, so if you look on SSRN under our names, it's there. So basically what we're looking for is a coherent framework to guide international, national, local regulation with respect to decent work. What do we mean by decent work? And here we're talking about the ILO's 1999 definition of decent work, which is really remarkably different in ways than it had been historically defined. Coming out of the Depression, everybody talked about full employment. Decent work began to move that debate beyond having a job, because people, not everyone has a job, and to think about it in terms of work and people's contributions to the economy, whether that's in the home, whether that's as a domestic worker in the informal economy, but to look at it, whether one is a self-employed vendor, to begin to look at ideas about work. And decent, again, not just in terms of numbers of jobs, but some kind of idea about some kind of level of quality and decency and dignity. Now, for the ILO, coming out of their 1999 launch of their Decent Work Initiative, they came up with four pillars of decent work that they thought, in terms of global governance, policy to guide sort of ILO members towards achieving this goal of decent work. And the pillars are promoting employment, enhancing social protection, promoting social dialogue, meaning negotiations at the workplace, all the way up to social dialogue to set national policy in terms of work. And then they had four rights. So this is policy guidelines, not regulation, policy guidelines, until you get to the fourth pillar, realizing rights at work. And those correspond with the core labor standards that the ILO came up with, which are the prohibition against forced labor, discrimination, child labor, and freedom of association. So this is the rights-based portion of the ILO program. Now, there's also an international human rights framework that really addresses many of the same issues. So we have kind of the social justice approach coming out of the ILO Constitution, basically saying that lasting peace is really only possible through social justice, and social justice is only possible, and lasting peace is only possible if we have freedom from want, and if we have freedom from poverty, and that's what's required in terms of social justice. Updated in the Declaration of Philadelphia following from World War II, and then more recently kind of reinvented in the Core Labor Standards and Decent Work Agenda, and most recently in the Declaration of Social Justice. The Declaration of Social Justice put decent work at the center of the ILO's program. The ILO really focuses on one thing these days, and that's decent work. In contrast to that, coming in later than the ILO, because of course the ILO was in many ways sort of the preventative answer to socialist revolution, coming at the end of World War II, we had the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Out of that, we have the Committees on Civil and Political Rights, Economic, Social, Cultural Rights, and then later declarations. So we have two very different trajectories and histories now coming together and talking about the focusing on a similar issue in terms of decent work. A major difference, I mean, there's some commonalities. So both the social justice and human rights approach both focus on inequality, poverty, sort of the most severely affected by the lack of decent work. But human rights encompasses, but then also goes beyond the social justice approach, because human rights talks about the fact that people all deserve it based on their fact that they're a human being, not just the poor, but everyone. Also, not just people as workers, but people as human beings in all facets of their lives. So, and also in terms of individual as well as collective kind of connection with that. Also unique to human rights is, and present from the Universal Declaration right up through the Vienna Declaration, are these ideas that human rights have three critical aspects to them: that they're universal and inalienable, that they're interrelated, and that human rights are indivisible, and that all human rights are equal. Sort of exploring that a little bit more closely, we see that universality, basically all human beings have these rights as a result of being human beings. So it doesn't touch on the issue of corporations and shares and equilibrium, because there's no equilibrium involved here. It's you're either a human being or you're not a human being. And also they're inalienable in the sense that no matter the equilibrium price, you cannot trade away your human rights to become a slave, for example. So they're inalienable as well. The next idea is interdependency, that rights cannot be compartmentalized into, you know, the civil and political rights over here, which we value, one person, one vote, versus economic and social rights, rights to education, right to health, right to housing. Rights are interdependent, and they're interdependent in two different ways. One is that there's a causality between rights. So, for example, in the International Covenant on Social and Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, there's a right to work. The right to work really only makes any sense if there's the right to freely choose work, which is listed separately. The right to freely choose work also implies the right to not work, the right to rest and leisure, which in itself depends on the right to social security and to paid time off. So there's this sort of causality. You can also see it in terms of the right to between civil and political versus social and economic rights. The right to a birth certificate for a child is considered a civil right, to a birth certificate. But very often, the only access to health care or education that a child will have will depend on that child's possession of a birth certificate. So that's one level of interdependence. Rights are also interdependent based on people's relationships. So, for example, we can imagine a case where workers are fired for exercising their freedom of association rights and they lose their jobs, and it goes to court and it gets adjudicated. But based on the interdependence of rights, those workers are not the only rights holders. If their families are affected by a loss of income as a result of their being fired, their children, their families are also right holders in terms of the relatedness of human rights. As a whole structure, when we look at all of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as it's been incorporated into treaties signed by and ratified by countries, the whole web of rights are indivisible. So, for example, countries that claim to embrace human rights, but except for women's rights, or claim to accept human rights, universal human rights, except for worker rights, really violate this fundamental notion of human rights, which is that they are all indivisible. Lastly, there's the idea of equality of rights, that rights cannot be hierarchically ranked, although very often countries and policymakers try to do so. But the fact is that people, individuals, families, communities, value different rights, and different rights are important to different people, and are important to people at different times. So the idea is that we can't privilege one set of human rights over another, and that governments are obligated to work towards the equal realization of all rights, not to privilege one set over another set. So with this as kind of a guide to look at decent work and work rights, we have two potential sources. We have the ILO Decent Work Agenda, which is a policy initiative with four rights in it. The ILO has conventions ratified by varying number of countries that are also relevant to decent work, to the pillars. But we also have a different potential source that we can look at to focus on decent work, which is the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, which has 160 countries which have ratified it. It is the single most comprehensive treaty to deal with work and economic and social rights in the world, and it has a universal framework, the universal framework I just spoke about in terms of universality, interdependence, indivisibility, and equality. So, for example, versus the ILO conventions, some of the same conventions have been ratified by only 30 or 28 countries, for example, on different rights that come under those four pillars of decent work. But those same countries have ratified the Convention on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. So the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights issued a general comment on the right to work, General Comment 18. And in that general comment 18, the committee said the right to work is the right to decent work. So in contrast to the ILO's policy goals and pillars, the Committee on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights says there's a human right to decent work and brings in many of those ILO conventions, whether they've been ratified by the 160 countries or not, encourages countries to ratify the convention so that there'll be closer supervision to implement them. But basically, the Committee on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights says there is a right to decent work, and the right to decent work includes those ILO conventions. Thinking about this holistic approach and how it could help in terms of reframing governance and directionality in achieving decent work, we developed four different strategies that we felt that this could be helpful in terms of guiding policy and regulation on achieving decent work. And there, but for each one, there's kind of a story or an example that will highlight how it works. The first is to define decent work holistically. Second, to recognize the interdependency of rights that are involved in decent work, not just the one that's immediately before you, but all of the rights that are implicated. To look at additional methods that are used in human rights that are not often used in terms of ILO or traditional kind of legal scenarios. And last, to build coalitions and social movements around connecting across the different rights and the interdependency. So what we're talking about is work rights broadly, the right to work, conditions at work, individual as well as collective, that family rights relate to work rights in terms of a family's right to decent, adequate standard of living, social security, and that defining the right to decent work holistically means that we have to go beyond the ILO's narrow definition of four core labor standards. So here we have an example of a worker in Honduras, a single mother of a 19-month-old baby who works 11 hours a day, 7 days a week, for a total of 77 hours a week, makes barely enough to get by, cannot afford to take a day off if she's sick, or to take her baby, her child, to a doctor, to take even time off to take her child to a doctor. If we use the ILO lens in terms of looking at her situation, in fact, there is a core labor standard problem because her hours amount to forced labor in Honduran law. The problem is if we cure that problem with forced labor and our single mother works less to do away with the forced labor problem, she simply makes less. She can't already get by on what she's making. So if we take away the forced labor problem and she works less, she probably will have to go out and get another job. She still doesn't have decent work, doesn't have enough to live on, doesn't have the resources to be able to have appropriate child care. So in this sense, we say if we use a human rights framework, we have to define the right to decent work holistically. The four core labor standards aren't really sufficient to be able to address it. Recognizing the interdependency of rights, understanding that all rights are interdependent based on both causality and interdependence of rights themselves as well as relationships. The example we have draws on soccer ball production in Pakistan. In the 1990s, the ILO, UNICEF, and local Chamber of Commerce all got together and were determined to do away with child labor in soccer ball production in Pakistan by essentially moving soccer ball production out of homes where it had been occurring into factories, centralized factories. And they could determine and be 100% sure that there were no children working in those soccer ball factories. It was completely successful. They eradicated child labor in soccer ball production. There were some other consequences as a result. Women had been able to work at home and balance work at home with work, paid work. So they could work part-time or full-time as it fit their schedules. There was no quality control. So, and the quality was high. Women worked when they could, and so when they moved it to the production centers, basically women's income went down. It's also considered very low status work, and women were jeered at when they went to factories to work in factories because culturally it's not acceptable for women in Pakistan to go to work. And as a result, women basically left that work and are no longer in soccer ball production. And in fact, the income of families involved went down when women left to work. So this is the idea that we really have to consider not just the immediate goal, but to think about the implications on other rights holders. Applying human rights methods, there's kind of a history of name and shame and sort of justiciability and sort of suits. All these new tools are being developed in human rights in terms of social and economic rights. Indicators, budget analysis to see how do budgets affect the human rights of domestically. Impact assessment, which basically takes kind of the tool of environmental impact, similar idea to try to anticipate what will the effects be on human rights. These things are being applied in other areas of human rights and could be applied in terms of decent work. In fact, sometimes when human rights impact assessment is done and it's meant to focus on communities, what happens is that you end up finding out about workplaces because, of course, work and community are connected. So in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, they tried to do an impact assessment on an extractive company that had all these really detrimental effects in terms of quality of water, quality of environment, but they also found out at the same time what the effects were on the workers in the extractive industries. And as a result of that, you have then the potential to sort of bring together community, workers, families, which leads to really the last example that we have about linking rights. Since rights are related, both causally and in terms of relationships, there are really excellent examples of sort of linking of social movements to enhance the realization of both decent work rights as well as other human rights. So there are examples of privatizations of healthcare along with the right to health and the effects that privatization has on access to healthcare and the merging of those social movements in terms of workers and communities. We have an example in Vermont where a worker center organized churches, communities, uninsured people on a healthcare initiative to basically reframe healthcare in Vermont as a human right, not a commodity to be bought from a health insurance company. And to do that, what they did was they came up with a human rights framework of what does it mean to have the right to access to health care. It was really unique in the sense that if anybody's followed healthcare debates in the U.S., they're very highly polarized. And if you say the word single payer or you say, whatever kind of bell word that you use, it's very polarizing. This group intentionally did not use any kind of phrase to say this is the policy we want. Instead, what they did, they came up with a human rights framework that said we want accessibility for everyone. We want healthcare not to be based on your job. We want, and so they framed it in healthcare terms, and the bill actually just passed the legislature to study different proposals for healthcare reform, but those healthcare reform proposals will be evaluated based on human rights criteria, based on meeting those human rights criteria. So in conclusion, back at the beginning, there really was kind of a shared universality or a shared kind of focus between the social justice and human rights. When you go back to the Declaration of Philadelphia and the ILO Constitution, it's all people, it's all workers that the ILO talks about. But as they implement their governance, it becomes conventions, and conventions are very narrowly focused and exclude people and exclude categories of workers and different kinds of rights. So we feel it would be that this would be a helpful framework in terms of guiding achieving decent work, and that there is actually a great deal of potential in complementarity between the ILO and international human rights frameworks, where both could really enhance each other. Thank you.
One actually links to Rich's earlier remark. I don't know if you were here at the time, but whether does this lead to more freedom or less freedom? The right framework, I'm not sure. I would like to know. But the second question is, given the interdependence of rights, do we need to consider human rights with human obligations in any way? Is there any interdependence with obligations? I have particularly one in mind, for example, right to reproduce. It didn't appear in any of these things. But is there a right to reproduction, unlimited right to reproduction? Does it have an interdependence with the right to work, job, food, shelter, and so on and so forth? And is there any relationship on it?
Well, in the freedom, does this lead to more freedom or less freedom? I'm not really sure how to address that because, yeah, I don't actually think there's a right to profit. And so much of what we talk about in regulation is about the right of companies to make money or the right of... So this is purely contractual. There is a convention. It's the Convention on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. 160 countries signed that contract. There are obligations as a committee that is represented by those countries, and they have met together and decided what the obligations are. So, for example, on the impact assessments, the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights expects those 160 countries to do impact assessments on rights. So it's a little bit about like you're explained. So, and there are shadow reports that come from NGOs as well. And so they go to the committee, and the committee says, explain. And part of what the committee is asking them to do is, in advance of that, to do those kinds of studies. So I do think, and I think that there are obligations in terms of respect, protect, fulfill. So some of the obligations are immediate. Some of them are progressive to within the available resources that the country has. And so I think that there's a mix of obligations. But yes, I think in terms of that convention, those international treaties, there are obligations.
Reproduction.
I know that in the Convention on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights, there's the family rights, the right to protection of family, particularly while responsible for care and education of children, the right of women to special protection before and after childbirth, the right of working mothers to paid leave or leave with Social Security benefits, the right of children and young persons to be protected from economic and social exploitation. And in terms of general family rights, I don't know if you want to, can you add?
I think there is a right to choice. Yeah.
Yes.
There is a right to choice.
But is there an obligation to limit population? That's what I'm asking.
Does the state have an obligation to limit population?
No, individuals.
Do individuals have an obligation to limit population? I don't think so. Other rights be fulfilled?
Well, these are treaties that countries ratify, and so neither corporations nor individuals are directly obligated by virtue of the.
Countries have an obligation to limit their population, so they can fulfill these rights.
I think that they would have a hard time fulfilling them if they didn't find some way to keep population within some limits. But they don't do it by violating rights. There's other ways.
I'm sure that's unsatisfactory. I think that's the best that we can come up with in terms of the right to.
I mean, I think if national governments or local governments help people realize their rights, they will probably have less children. And if they have less children, they will be able to enjoy the right to health, for example, more. Like women who have 20 children have worse health than women who have fewer children. So I think that it's actually, just as she was explaining, they're connected. Help people realize their economic and social rights.
They're going up 1 billion every 15 years. They're going up 1 billion every 15 years.
And I think that you can't, a government will have very, very difficult time helping people enjoy their economic and social rights unless they're able to help people reduce the number of children that they're having. And that will also improve their ability to enjoy their rights. It's not that healthy, actually.
But I think they would consider forced sterilization of women a violation of human rights.
Yes. It has to be a choice.
Yes. Other questions?
You mentioned some of the pragmatic mechanisms that are being utilized, because this is essentially a normative framework, too.
Yep.
You mentioned a few of the pragmatic implementation mechanisms, like NGOs. That, but I don't know who the 160 countries are, but my guess is empirically the that you find that the rights are more absent than present in those 160 countries.
Well, I think that's why we talked about respect, protect, fulfill. That I think within the international human rights framework, that some rights are immediate obligations, like the obligation not to discriminate. But some are progressive.
You're talking about a normative situation. You're not talking about the empirical reality.
Well, I think that's true. Yes.
I think that in the Covenant on Human Rights of the Holocaust, I think that's why they have the provision of progressive realization. But I think when they adopted this treaty, they knew that a lot of countries would be able to implement this full system of social protection immediately and so on. And so the idea is that you're supposed to be taking concrete steps towards providing
Or they merely have signed the treaty and have no intention.
Once they sign it, then they at least you can use it as a tool to try to...
Have to explain.
I'm wondering about that. How does it actually go about? How does that take place?
How are they implemented?
Okay. Take any given right in any given place.
Yeah.
And if it's violated systematically.
Yeah.
By a country that signed the treaty. How do you actually go about dealing with
it? There are several mechanisms that if the country has ratified the treaty, then they have to report to the Committee on Sexual and Gender Rights. And so, and at that, Helen Zhang was saying that the country has to send in a report, and usually NGOs get together and send in a shadow report, and the committee will. There's other systems as well, particularly there's a periodic report now that goes directly to the Human Rights Commission, where the countries also examine the human rights record across all rights, whether they ratify the conventions or not. There's a special rapporteurs with commissions to countries on specific rights and often specific issues.
And you mentioned Honduras.
Yeah.
And Honduras is actually has ratified the convention.
So what happened to that woman?
Oh, I'm sure nothing.
Well, that's what I mean.
Well, yes, and that's partly why we're saying is, I guess ultimately, you know, we decide which normative framework comes first. And I think partly what we're arguing, and it's an argument because it's a political question, because we will decide, among others, which normative framework we choose. We're arguing for adopting a human rights framework to reorder things in such a way that they would be evaluated and judged based on that normative framework. And so that's partly exactly why we're arguing that Honduras and that the ILO and the Committee on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights should work together to hold Honduras to account. Now, for the first time, there is a complaint procedure coming into effect or that has been created for economic, social, cultural rights violations by the Committee on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights. So in the future, there actually is the potential for a complaint mechanism that's just coming into play.
In the traditional way, you argued that human rights are absolute, unconditional rights that must be attributed to human beings because they are human beings. This is the traditional way of arguing. And your speech was about right of decent work.
Yes.
And we can observe that the definition of what is a decent work is changing in time, is changing with standard of living, with technical progress, with GDP, etc., etc. That means the material content of this right is changing in time, is not unconditional, it's not absolute, is depending on certain conditions, social conditions. How does this fit with your definition of human rights?
Well, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because one of the things I should have said in the original pillars, that when I said this is different than past systems for dealing with full employment, is that the ILO, I think quite brilliantly, said, you know, decent work is actually needed everywhere. And so there's a deficit in decent work in Europe, as well as in the poorest country in Africa, for exactly that reason, that what is decent work really depends on local conditions. And so if you have people that are in precarious employment in Europe, they need to have social protection and social dialogue. And that's really one of the departures of decent work that I should have put much more emphasis on than in the past, because exactly your point, that it is different things in different places. And the ILO is actually coming up with methods to look at and to assess what are the decent work deficits in developed countries versus undeveloped countries. And so they're working to define that in terms of local context. Because you're exactly right, it is different in different places.
Well, if I may ask you this. See, this normative framework really, as you, I think, rightly pointed out, doesn't allow any trade-offs among rights. That's the framework here. And what I have in mind is, in fact, there are trade-offs, even if our framework does not permit it. So let's take, say, China's one-child policy. And many analysts attribute many aspects of China's development, elimination of hunger, economic development, better life, better jobs, and so on, to one-child policy. Does this framework, normative framework, deal with that?
I think it does in the sense that I think that you said that doesn't allow any trade-offs of rights. I think one of the normative guidelines that we're trying to emphasize is first to take into account all of the different rights that are involved. Because so often, like for example, the case of soccer balls, they're not even really seen. They're invisible, and we just go on. So the first thing is to see the interconnection of rights. And secondly, I think that at the beginning, in terms of the human rights framework, as I think I said at the beginning, a country that says that they embrace human rights except for workers' rights does not embrace international human rights. So I think that that's true. There may be trade-offs, but the idea is that you have to, that it's indivisible, that you cannot say that one right is privileged over another, because a human being might really value her right to reproduce freely, and another human being might have a different value. And the idea is that none of us can tell people what they should value, I think, is part of the framework. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very
much. Thanks. So, I'm proposing these two papers on the formation of rule by market transaction, better regaining principle, universal principle, for compliant debate. Thank you very much for participating.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.